From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the great things about NPR's Planet Money reporting team is their ability to take complicated, positively Byzantine issues and turn them into stories that not only make sense, but leave you captivated. One of the most recent examples of this is Alex Blumberg and Laura Seidel's journey to explore the practice of patent trolling. This is where a company uses a patent, not for the purpose of creating anything or even really protecting an invention. Trolling is when you use a patent as a weapon to make money by suing someone. Today in the program, Alex and Laura will join us to take us through their story. We'll talk about what they found and what all of this is doing to creativity and innovation. When Patents Attack, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. How do you make a story about patent law interesting? And not just like, that's interesting, but intriguing and compelling and enraging. Well, it's a good question, but somehow Alex Blumberg and Laura Seidel did it not so long ago. They produced a piece for NPR in the program This American Life that explored patent law and the practice of patent trolling. This is where a company uses a patent not for the purpose of inventing something or really even protecting an invention. These companies buy the patent to use it as a weapon to make money by threatening to sue other companies. Today in the program, Alex and Laura are joining us to take us through their story called When Patents Attack. We're talking about what they found and what all of this is doing to creativity and innovation. Alex Blumberg is a contributing editor to NPR's Planet Money podcast, a producer for This American Life, of course, a journalism professor also at Columbia University. And Alex is joining us today from the studios of This American Life in New York City. And Alex, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks very much.
Laura Seidel is with us. She covers digital culture for NPR, and she's joining us from an NPR studio in San Francisco. And Laura Seidel, welcome to you.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to start by asking you, when did you both start thinking about doing a story about all of this? I mean, what was the thing that got you started?
Well, Laura got me started, so I should let Laura.
Well, you know, I have to say, I guess part of it is, you know, I live here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Alex was visiting, and I had a cup of coffee with him, and I started telling him some stories about inventors I knew and their struggles with the patent system, because you hear it a lot living out here. People kind of run up against strange software patents they didn't know existed, and it kind of keeps them from moving forward without paying large sums of money. And we had this conversation over coffee, and it started out, I was just thinking of doing a couple pieces for Morning Edition. And before you know it, Alex and I sort of ended up going down this trail that led us to places we really never expected. I had heard the term patent troll.
Right.
And we said, well, let's figure out what that is. And we found this one company that people were calling a patent troll called Intellectual Ventures. And it's a company that's in Seattle, and it was founded by Nathan Myhrvold, the former CTO of Microsoft. And we went up there and visited, and they were telling us, gee, we're all about innovation here and funding innovation. And I said, well, you know, you're helping inventors. Give me an inventor you've helped.
Right.
And they handed me, you know, this one name, and I called him back later. I said, well, how do I get this guy? And suddenly they kind of pulled back, and they said, actually, you know, we no longer own that patent. And it's in litigation, so we don't think the inventor, a guy named Chris Crawford, is going to actually talk to you. And that, Alex, I guess, is what really kind of led us down this rabbit hole.
So wait, right. did you figure did you wonder, like, I don't know if we have a story until you were able to find the, you know, Chris Crawford? Did you wonder if it was going to work?
I think we were starting, we originally thought we were going to be doing a sort of a smaller story.
Yeah.
And this often happens where you know, you start for me anyway. I think maybe just it might say more about me than about journalism in particular. But I can't really do small somehow. I've every hour-long story I've ever done, I've always started. It's going to be like 5-10 minutes, I think. But and originally, I think the original idea was we wanted to just find somebody who was a self-described patent troll.
Yeah.
Who would sort of admit to it, because there was this phenomenon, and I thought, okay, just for a general audience, let's just report on that phenomenon and just get somebody. How do you do the business of being a patent troll? Talk about where you get your patents, how you decide what's a good patent to buy versus how do you decide who to sue. Just sort of just going straight logistics, not leaving aside good or bad for innovation, all that sort of stuff. We just wanted to just sort of profile this, and then Laura, I think, asking around, intellectual ventures just kept coming up. And so that was originally the idea. It was just sort of like, what do they say they are, and how do they talk about what they do?
Hmm. Well, I think what surprised me in the piece, among a lot of things actually, was the level of fear. People are afraid of saying much, of not only getting sued, but really talking. It must have been incredibly difficult in that way to report.
Alex and I went back and forth on this a lot. You know, we would sort of have these lists of people who were being sued, say, by intellectual ventures or being sued with a particular patent. And you'd call and they would be like, well, we'll talk to you off the record.
Yeah.
But we can't talk to you on the record. We went through this a lot, Alex. It's my recollection.
Yeah, I think we called. There was the one patent. So after they... they gave us Chris Crawford, and then they ungave Chris Crawford to us.
Right.
And then we figured, okay, well, Chris Crawford's going to be the backbone of this. And just, we started trying to find out as much as we could about that. And that became sort of the backbone of the story, as just the search for this guy and his patent became the search. And at a certain point, we discovered that his patent was being used to sue a whole bunch of companies all up and down, all throughout, the tech industry. And we called every single one of the companies that was being sued. And I think it was like 16, 17 companies.
Yeah, wow. It was about 16 or 17.
And none of them would talk to us.
Yeah, they never really would. We did get a lawyer who was representing one of them, and he spoke with us a bit more generally, but not the actual companies. They never would speak with us.
So I guess you knew about, of course, you knew that there were such things as patent trolls, of course. I mean, that's the thing that got you started. But I guess the thing that's surprising for a lot of people is that this is not how it's supposed to work, that you have companies like Intellectual Ventures who, I guess it's weird that they have a lab in the first place. Which they do. You talk about that in the piece. But they don't really, they're not really creating anything of commercial value. That's not, I don't know if that's a shell or a front, kind of a front. Maybe that's not fair to say that, or I'm defaming them in some way. But do you know what I mean? But the story is about that. It's not about creativity and imagination or innovation. It's about a threat.
Well, I think, I did get the feeling that on some level, Nathan Myhrvold believes that he's creating this playground for creating new inventions, like, mosquito zappers for the third world that will work, across, landmass the size of a lake to, zero in and kill mosquitoes to help prevent malaria. And he has things like that that he's working on. But yeah, nothing goes to market. And it seems more like a plaything that's kind of on top of what the larger business model is for this company. And whether it's intentionally set up to divert people, I can't read their minds, but it certainly starts to look like that.
It's very mysterious. We ask that a lot. Like, what started what? Did it start as a lab and this was the intention as sort of, we're going to just invent all these things and it's going to be the sort of like incubator of invention, and then it was just harder than they thought and so they started buying up patents and then they went down the road that we sort of reported on?
Yeah.
Or was this always their intention, sort of the buying and the buying of the patents and then the sort of the licensing them out for revenue? That was always their core business, and the lab was sort of an afterthought. It's impossible to know.
The other thing, of course, that is so baffling is that you found that having a patent doesn't mean that your idea is new or that you thought of this thing first. We talk about how 30% of patents are for things that have already been invented. And I wanted to play this clip, and maybe you can help me set this up. It's talking with David Martin, and he's in front of this computer screen, I guess.
Yeah.
Is that enough to set this up? You want to say something about this?
Well, yeah, he has this proprietary system that does that compares the language in all the patents and patent applications that are in the U.S. And I think it's actually global. I think it's a global system. So basically, what he does is his system goes through and it can sort of compare all these different patents and it can sort of match them. Allegedly match them by whether or not they overlap at all. Mm-hmm. And so part of the problem with patents is that some patents say, you know, they'll use different words to describe the same thing. He used the example of a plug can also be a hermaphroditic upstanding plug from a platform or something right. like that. And so a lot of times, like, people will do that. They'll sort of have different language to describe the same thing. So his software sort of uncovers that.
Yeah.
Well, here it is.
I would say that kind of sets it up pretty well, I think.
Yeah.
David Martin says that when he first started looking into this stuff and saw all these patents that were granted for essentially the same thing,
we thought that would be an anomaly. And then we were told, oh, no, it's not an anomaly. That happens. So that's what got us into the rabbit hole you're about to see, which is to say, well, let's see how many times that happens. Mm-hmm. And as I've testified in Congress, that happens about 30% of the time in U.S. patents.
That is, 30% of U.S. patents are essentially for things that have already been invented.
So, for example, toast becomes the thermal refreshing of a bread product.
These are real patents?
There's a patent on toast?
Yes. Thermally refreshing bread, not on toast.
Ladies and gentlemen, patent number 6080436, bread refreshing method, issued in 2000.
This has got to be the most famous part of the story, I think, for people, right? I mean, how many people talk to you about the toast part of the story?
Yes, people are still disputing with me, actually, whether it's really for toast. And it's actually for a method of making toast, I will admit. But it is a method of making toast. And I don't know how many new methods there really are of making toast, you know?
But come on, it's toast, right? I mean, it's toast.
The thing that was vindicated to me, there was an IP lawyer. Some IP lawyers were writing to us after the show and saying, like, no, that's for a method of making toast, not for toast. But then other IP lawyers wrote to us and said, well, it's actually basically, you're right. It's for toast.
So
I felt like, yeah.
I have to say that in general, it's probably been lawyers who've often said to us, oh, no, you weren't looking deep enough into it. And, you know, I think sometimes people get so deeply involved in something, they really can't see the forest through the trees. Mm-hmm. And I did feel, Alex, that in some ways you and I were kind of coming at this and going like, wait a minute, you know, seeing the forest, and sometimes some of the people in it are so deeply involved in finding a new word for toast, you know, that they really can't see that it's still toast. You know?
I guess the idea of just how many programmers are not happy about this. I mean, I guess you have some examples of that in the piece, but it's not just anecdotal. I mean, you talk about in polls, I think it was like 80% of software engineers say this is not good. This system is not, it's not actually working. It's stifling innovation.
Yeah, and that was the thing that to me was the sort of the heart of the story, is that there's this, the idea of the patent system, it's set up to help the inventor. You know, the idea is that you invent something, and if somebody can just sort of take it apart and build it themselves, then you will have less incentive to invent something. So mm-hmm. the government grants you basically a monopoly over this thing. And most people want to be granted a monopoly. That's a good thing. Yeah. If you have a monopoly, you can charge more money, and you know, you can make a mint. And so that's what people want. And the idea for the patent system is that by giving somebody a monopoly, that actually helps society at large. And here's this whole group of people that are saying, no, we don't want this monopoly power. Right. It's getting in our way. Yeah.
Right.
You know, the inventors themselves say it's getting in their way. And, you know, again, I sort of have to go back to, it really is usually the lawyers who are defending it the most and are sort of I felt it was a little bit like, oh, these inventors, they don't really understand. And, you know, I mean, they're the ones who are doing it, and the system is really meant to be for the benefit of society so that these inventors feel safe sharing their ideas so somebody's not just going to steal it. But if they're the ones who are saying, no, that's not what's happening, I feel like you have to listen.
And the other thing that people would point out, especially in software professionals would point out, is that it's not like software isn't already legally protected. It has copyright protection. Yeah. So the way, you know, we talk about how the idea of the patent goes back to the Constitution. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but the word patent isn't in the Constitution. The idea is that you want to create a system that where inventors can profit from the thing they invent.
Promote the progress of science.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. And the arts, right.
And the arts, yeah. Right.
And so as long as there's some kind of protection, and so there's a bunch of different types of protection that have come up, and one of those is copyright and one of those is patent. And it's very rare that something has both.
Mm-hmm. And software does have both, and you see that. And many people think copyright would be sufficient for patents, and as we brought up in the piece, initially the patent office was reluctant to give software patents. They were very reserved about it, and it was the courts who actually pushed them in this direction. And then when they started doing it in the 90s, they kind of started doing it like crazy. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they really didn't have the tools or the background and experience often to really know if a particular patent was overlapping on other things that had already been done. Because part of it, when you're granting a patent and you give somebody a monopoly, I mean, this is a huge thing to say for 20 years, you own this invention, right? So they're supposed to look at it carefully. They're supposed to find that it's really novel. But they didn't have the tools to do that. They didn't know the field very well. And so it seemed to us, in the case of, for example, the Chris Crawford patent, he was patenting something that a lot of people were doing at the time. Yeah. But the patent office didn't know that. And so you have all these patents on things that, you know, maybe shouldn't have been granted because you gave somebody a monopoly on something that really wasn't all that novel or really needed protection, or in any way did it really serve society to grant that protection. So, you know, you've ended up with this huge problem, particularly in the world of software patents. And I want to emphasize that, you know, Alex and I were in no way trying to say like, oh, patents are a bad thing. But we were looking at this particular area, which is software patents. Right. And saw this incredible trouble, which you are now seeing, I think, by the end of the piece, you know, we start to look at what are sort of these patent wars going on in these big corporations. You know, you see right now, for example, this big war over the Android operating system that's going on, where Microsoft is getting licensing deals from all these companies because of software and that. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars being spent on these patents that may be of dubious quality.
So Innovative Ventures, they sold Chris Crawford's patent to this company called Oasis Research, and you talk about that. And so you tried to find Oasis, and this is another, I have to say, really kind of brilliant parts of the story, where you actually go to this place, you find an address, that's about all you could find about Oasis, this place in Marshall, Texas. Let me play another clip here. So you went there.
What are you opening the door? Right now, we're going into the first floor of the Baxter Building, which is 104 East Houston.
This is Michael Smith. He's an attorney in Marshall, Texas, who does mostly patent cases. He agreed to show us the offices of Oasis Research. They're in a nondescript two-story building on the town's main square, two doors down from the federal courthouse. This is Oasis. He led us into a narrow corridor lined with doors with gold and black office nameplates.
And here we go, Suite 190, Oasis Research, LLC.
It was late morning on a weekday, not a holiday, but the door was locked. Through the crack underneath, you could see there were no lights on inside. Marshall is a very small town, 24,000 people. Michael was born and raised here, so we started quizzing him about Oasis.
Does it have any employees that you know about?
Not that I know of.
Have you ever seen any people coming in and out of that office?
No, I haven't. Is this office ever occupied? I doubt that it is.
Let's if you don't mind, I'm going to knock on the door and just see if there's anyone here today.
I know this is kind of a cliche at this point, knocking on the door of the suspected fake office.
Nothing.
But we'd flown a long way.
Alex, I love this. The question, is this office ever occupied? Which seems like such a, what? But is it? Do you know, is it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to prove a negative.
Somebody must go in there sometime, Alex.
here would be the evidence that you could marshal to say that it is never occupied. Yeah. We went back several times. We went back another time during the day, knocked again later in the afternoon. Nobody was there. The office is a, it's in a corridor of offices that all seem the same and are all plaintiffs in lawsuits, just as Oasis was a plaintiff in a lawsuit. So it has the feel of offices that have just been basically they're paper companies that have been set up to sue, and they show an address in Marshall, but they don't actually have any business in operation there. And in fact, that very room, the suite down to the suite number, suite 190, I think it was, is occupied by another sort of non-practicing entity, is what they call them, that is also involved in another lawsuit involving an intellectual ventures patent. So somehow Oasis Research, if it does exist, if there are actual employees, they are also sharing their office with another company called Lodsys, which is doing the same thing that they're doing.
So maybe they're having lunch together, but we didn't see them.
Right. I guess what confused me was why it was so difficult to come up with an example of someone. I mean, when you ask them at Intellectual Ventures. All right, well, give me an example of someone who made a breakthrough discovery and wasn't getting paid. That was the point, at least initially. And they could come up with this Chris Crawford, which, of course, didn't pan out. But they've purchased something like 30,000 patents. I mean, surely they could come up with someone to you know what I mean? I mean, there's got to be. I mean, I understand that maybe this is more about the threat and this, but surely there's got to be some patents that are actually protecting people who have breakthroughs, or is that not at all the case?
I did talk to somebody who, you know, we didn't use her in the piece, who had an invention, and basically she had a startup, it had gone out of business, and they bought the patents, but she was now going back to school for something else and just using the money. You know, so it wasn't like, even the person they gave me that I did talk to, it wasn't like, oh, she's bringing this great product to market or something, you know? Mm. So I don't know. They never handed me anything where we really saw that.
And part of the problem, I think, and this gets back to the problem with a software patent, you know, we talked to a lot of software engineers and software professionals, and it's hard to, like, a lot of them said to us, it's really like there are breakthroughs in software, but it's such an iterative process where somebody designs a feature and somebody says they can sort of tweak that feature and make it a little bit better, and everybody's sort of thinking it, and it's very collaborative. So it doesn't really, that's why a lot of them, I think, oppose the idea of patents, because the business itself doesn't really lend itself to the idea of, like, the Isaac Newton breakthrough, you know, where it's like somebody has a eureka moment and I'm going to change the way programming has been done, you know, or something like that. I mean, it happens, but I think those are rare. And then the other thing is, like, when it does happen, like the guy who, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the internet, and is widely credited as inventing the internet, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think he patented that idea, right, Laura?
No, he didn't. He didn't.
He doesn't have any patents to his name.
Yeah.
The Google algorithm, which is, you know, sort of revolutionized search, and I believe that is not patented. That's just simply a trade secret.
They have some patents early on, but a lot of it isn't. A lot of what they do is just kept secret. You know,
yeah.
The patents were not really, I would say, the core of what makes Google work.
And that's one of the, I think that's a little bit of the issue here, is that sort of for so long, for a lot of the early period in software, when a lot of this stuff was really, really sort of when things were being, you know, when there were breakthroughs happening, right, the patents weren't available for software. Software was considered basically a mathematical formula. You can't patent an equation. Mm. And so software was considered sort of similar to that. And so it wasn't until, like, the early mid 90s where software patents became available because of all these court decisions that the patents started rolling in. And by then it was sort of like a lot of people just sort of like, if there's an idea out there and you can describe it in a patent application and there's not a patent application already in existence, which there wouldn't be because they weren't really allowed beforehand, then you get the patent. Mm. So I think that's part of the problem as well.
And that's why you get some of these kind of weird things, because you're not patenting the mathematical formula underneath. You're patenting, you know, sort of like, oh, the one-click method, you know, yeah. Which was in fact a case, you know, Amazon's one-click method. And they lost in this particular instance. The courts didn't uphold the patent. But, you know, it's like, really? The one-click method? That's a patent? You know?
That's Laura Seidel, NPR's digital culture reporter. Alex Bloomberg with us also, contributing editor of NPR's Planet Money podcast and a producer for This American Life. Laura's on deadline, so we have to let her go. Laura, thank you very much for the time.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
And Alex, stay with us. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the battle over patents. It's a battle between software companies for market supremacy, where patents are used as the weapons. NPR's Planet Money reporters Alex Bloomberg and Laura Seidel have been with us today to take us through their story to understand the complicated and confusing patent system. Their story, When Patents Attack, appeared on NPR's All Things Considered and also on This American Life. Alex Bloomberg is still with us. Joining us now on the program is Mike Masnick, who is CEO and founder of the blog TechDirt.com. He's joining us from a studio at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. And Mike Masnick, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we wanted to talk to you so you could give us a little bit of sort of historical context to all of this. And I figured sort of let's start from the beginning, because you've written about the fact that the foundation, the basic principles for patent law and copyright law, for that matter, I guess, is incredibly basic. As you say, 27 simple words. Talk about how kind of essential and basic it is.
Sure. I mean, it's a really simple concept. It is to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, which often gets confused because it's actually science was actually for copyright and useful arts is actually what they meant for patents. Everyone kind of always assumes it's the other way around.
And
the method for doing that is to provide some sort of monopoly for a limited period of time, with the hope and the expectation that within that amount of time, it would give enough time for the creator to benefit.
And the idea was, I guess, that this was supposed to benefit wider society.
Sure.
Freeze inventors to, you know, not hide the things that they're discovering, but disclose their work so people can benefit from it.
Sure. And this is actually a pretty common misunderstanding of both the copyright and the patent system, which is a lot of people assume that it was designed to benefit the creator of the works. And that's actually not the case. It is to promote the progress, which is to promote the overall benefit for wider society. Was very much the key to it from the very beginning. And actually, you know, some of the very early fears about the implementation of it was whether or not it would really benefit society. And of course, you know, a lot of what we're hearing today and is about how in many ways it appears that it doesn't. But the very core underpinning is the benefit for society.
You talk about how the patent system is kind of mythologized as one of the core reasons for innovation and growth. And you say, which we'll talk about, that it doesn't seem to be true any yeah. longer. But was it ever true? I mean, has it ever been true?
there's definitely a question for that. And you'll hear, I mean, there are arguments there. And you'll hear very different stories from very different people. But, you know, you can go back pretty far and see lots of evidence to the contrary, you know, pretty much from the beginning of the patent system. And if you look back, you know, way back, sort of where the idea of the patent came from, it really was, you know, it was a monopoly favor from the king to someone, you know, so you would get a patent on, you know, sugar production, right? So, you know, basically it was a favor that said, okay, you know, my friend is the only one who can sell sugar in the entire kingdom. And from that sort of, you know, came the wider patent system. And so, you know, as it developed, you can look and sort of try and find examples of, you know, did it ever benefit society as a whole? And, you know, there are some arguments that maybe in some places it did, but you can find, you know, arguments going back to, you know, especially within the U.S., going back to Europe and certainly England, where obviously a lot of our original intellectual property laws came from. And you find a lot of examples of it hindering progress and holding back innovation, going back 200, 250 years.
Alex, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I first of all, without Mike's work, we could not have done our story. So, I mean, it's actually a pleasure to meet you, and I'm a big fan.
The
argument that you hear is that I don't know enough to like speculate about whether or not the patent system entirely, the idea of the patent is a washed up, concept or not. We talked to an economist, a couple of economists for the Planet Money podcast that we did about this. What this guy said, and he'd done a bunch of research basically trying to find out if there's data about, if there's strong patent protection, does innovation, and he was measuring innovation by how much companies are willing to spend on R&D, does it increase or decrease? And what he was saying is that the software patent presents a problem because if you look at it over time, since software patents were introduced, R&D spending has decreased, leading him to think that it actually hinders innovation. It doesn't help innovation. Mm-hmm. And he says it's in direct contrast to other fields, for example, specifically pharmaceuticals, he said, where the method of expressing a drug is very, very clear. And it's not, you patent something, you know exactly what you've patented, and people know exactly what they need to stay away from. And he said, in that sense, once there's strong patent protection in place, you see R&D spending go up, which led him to believe that in that instance, it's actually leading to greater innovations. In other words, it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. Hmm. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who have, drug companies, that's like there's definitely another side, but that is like, that's the pro-patent argument, I think.
It's interesting. I mean, if you talk about, Mike Masnick, the fact that this was supposed to benefit, wider society, and then you hear Alex and Laura's piece, like, how far away are we from any kind of concept of what this is supposed to mean for not just for innovation but for society? I mean, how far away are we from the concept at all?
I think we're really far away from it. Part of the problem is, in a lot of ways, and this was definitely made clear in kind of the first half of the show, is that the system has very much been taken over by the lawyers, and the lawyers profit from it, absolutely. No doubt about it. And I certainly know plenty of patent attorneys, here in Silicon Valley, many of whom were engineers, who now admit that, even though they could probably benefit society a lot more by going out and building programs and software and doing cool stuff, starting companies even, it's much more profitable for them to become a patent attorney and make a ton of money.
What's interesting, too, I think, is that this concern about people abusing the patent system, it's not really that new. I mean, you write about the fact that the same concern came out of the last half of the 19th century. There were these. So today we have patent trolls. Then we had patent sharks, I think.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, if you go back 150 years, there was this whole fear of something called patent sharks. And it was, very, very similar. I mean, the parallels are almost uncanny. And you look at it and it was people who would get patents on sort of, basic kinds of farm machinery. And then they would travel around from farm to farm. And with the document, which was their patent in hand, and say, that machine you're using to, whatever, pick corn or who knows what, that infringes on this patent, and you have to pay up, or we're going to sue you. And it's the exact same story of very broad patents being issued, and then on very obvious ideas or ideas that were very much widely in use. And then the people who are holding those patents going around and you know, using the threat of litigation or actual litigation in order to force people to pay up.
And this actually kept coming up with us in a purely storytelling sense. We needed the idea, the patent story, you know, to sort of set up at the beginning. Sort of like, here's what a patent is, here's how it's supposed to work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was like, well, you know, okay, so it's a Thomas Edison. He must have had a patent on something. And then you start looking into Thomas Edison, and there's like, if you like Google Thomas Edison and patent, you'll find that he was like maybe, you know, one of the most egregious examples of a patent troll, according to some people.
Who didn't really invent anything or
You can go through every one of Thomas Edison's famous inventions and find out that he didn't invent any of them, you know, and in some cases a little more sketchy than in other cases, but you know, none of them came from Thomas Edison.
And then the one we finally did settle on was Eli Whitney and the cotton gin, which is sort of, you know, the idea. And then after we ran it, all these people wrote in and said, actually, Eli Whitney doesn't really work either, because when he invented the cotton gin, his patent protection, he was the first, but then his patent didn't do anything. And just people, it was a pretty simple idea once you saw it, and then just people copied it anyway, and he had no method of enforcement, and the idea spread like wildfire anyway.
Well, the thing that it raises, and I think this seems relevant today, is that it's not about the thing. It's not about the innovation. It's not about the invention. I mean, Edison is good at, and this seems incredibly important, at the process of marketing his idea, and which you say, Mark, that history is written by the victors. That's one of the lessons here, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and not to put down Thomas Edison, who was a fantastic, he did two things very, very well. One is, you know, recognizing inventions that could be then brought to market in a really useful manner. And then also marketing it. And both of those are really important. You know, if you are looking at that original idea of the patent system, and that is to benefit society, you know, I don't think anyone argues that Thomas Edison didn't benefit society. He did a tremendous amount to benefit society, but it wasn't from the invention side of things. It was from taking the inventions that other people came up with and actually making them both useful to the market and then getting them out to the market in a way that people understood and people, you know, would embrace. And that's, you know, that's the thing that's completely missing from patents and the patent debate. There's nothing in a patent that says you have to even have built what you're patenting, let alone, you know, actually bring it to market.
Mm. Right. It's a purely negative power. Like the only power that it gives you is to stop somebody else from building it. And so if it gets, and that's the other thing, if it gets in the wrong hands, and like the idea is hopefully that you will not do that. You'll actually license it to somebody, and it'll be a win-win, and then they'll build it too, and it gets spread that way. But there's nothing in the patent system that says that has to happen. Somebody could just be a schmuck and just say, no, mm-hmm. nobody can build it but me. And then society's worse.
Well, you, Mike Mesnick, you write about the thing that drives innovation, and it mm-hmm. seems to sort of come back to the, which seems kind of elemental, but need and competition.
Yeah.
Necessity is the mother of invention, and you say it's not just a cliche. That's kind of true.
Yeah, and I mean, there's plenty of research on this. You know, if you look at, you know, actual innovation and actual things that hit the market, you know, what is it that's driving it? It's almost always a case of need, and in many cases, you know, self-need, not something that, you know, someone looks at and says, oh, you know, I want to invent this because it's some, you know, it's a brilliant idea. It's someone saying, I need to do X and I need Y in order to be able to accomplish X. And so therefore, you know, it's not, people aren't sitting down saying, I'm going to, you know, make this wonderful new thing because I can get a patent. Mm. And you know, when you look at great innovations, the value of patents and making the decision to actually create those innovations, it's almost non-existent. It's
well,
very,
say,
very rare.
Say something about that, because you use the historical evidence of the steam engine. Because I was thinking about, okay, so let's examine what happens. Let's say I have that better mousetrap. And so what happens to my mousetrap in a world with and a world without patents? So what happens to it without patents?
Sure.
And what happens with it? Because you write about that.
Sure. So, and there's, you know, it's tough to predict parallel worlds, right?
Sure.
But you can certainly find parallel situations. You can look at things. But, you know, the steam engine certainly is, and this is another sort of classic along the lines of Eli Whitney, you know, example that's used for you know, the wonders of the patent system. But if you look at the steam engine and James Watt, you know, first of all, he also sort of built on the work of someone else who came before him and then patented it and worked very, very hard at enforcing his patents and then actually extending the length of his patents. But, you know, the reality is that his version of the steam engine didn't actually work that well and actually wasn't all that useful. Whereas a couple simple modifications made what he did very useful, but he was unable to do them and didn't. And so if you look at sort of how widely the steam engine was used during the period of time in which he had the patent coverage, it really wasn't that great. And what's really interesting is that basically as soon as, and again, he did push really hard to extend his patents and get them and to be enforceable for longer. But as soon as those patents finally went away, suddenly there was a massive spike in innovation around the steam engine. And the small modifications to his design that actually made the steam engine useful suddenly came into play, which certainly suggests that they were ready before that, but he worked very hard to keep them from hitting the market. And then suddenly the steam engine became very useful and became sort of widely known and widely available. So I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence and there's plenty of case studies along those lines in which, you know, the actual innovation during the period of patent protection is relatively slow and not much happens. And then almost immediately after stuff goes off patent, suddenly there's a rapid fire innovation and much greater market acceptance and much wider benefit to society. And yet, you know, if you're looking at, you know, what happens in a world without patents, you know, one argument is that, oh, well, nobody, you know, nobody does anything because everyone can copy them. But, you know, again, you just look right back at that case, which was suddenly lots of players actually entered the market for steam engines because there was a market there, right? There's this idea that, you know, patents are the only incentive for invention and innovation. And yet, you know, there's a market, right? I mean, the market is the incentive where, you know, you want to sell something to people. And so, you know, and if you can do it without patents and you can improve on it and you can keep, you know, building the better mousetrap, you know, let's focus on, you know, letting the market decide and letting people, you know, say, I want the best mousetrap and I'll pay for the best mousetrap.
We're pretty much out of time, but let me ask you both this finally. I guess the question is, Alex, did you come into any conclusions about whether or not this mess can be fixed? You know, is it, I mean, Mike, you write about this as well. Alex, you first.
Well, it does seem like there's a patent protection bias, and I feel like this actually goes back to the, sort of the way that patents are thought about inside policy circles. I actually talked to a government official who's involved in the patent office, and he was explaining the difference between Europe and the United States, and he said, well, we're just a little bit more free market, so that's why we let more of these patent applications through. And I remember thinking, like, no, that's the opposite of free market. You know, you are creating a government monopoly. You're creating more government-sponsored monopolies if you have a more liberal patent system. So, and I think if it can be dialed back a little bit, and maybe like sort of less patents is probably better.
Mike Masnick, final word.
Yeah, I mean the biggest thing for me is really recognizing obviousness, and you know, a patent is not supposed to be obvious to those skilled in the art, and I think we've completely ignored that in the actual impact of how patents are done, and if we, you know, allowed for things like independent invention and recognizing that lots of people are coming up with the same thing at the same time, and that those kinds of inventions shouldn't be patentable, we'd have a much better system.
That's Mike Masnick. He's CEO and founder of the blog TechDirt.com. Mike, thanks very much for the time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Alex Blumberg, a contributing editor to NPR's Planet Money and a producer for This American Life. Alex, thanks very much to you.
It's a pleasure.
You can find a link to the story, When Patents Attack, on our website, KUER.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.